Big Red Bench. Game on. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.
The Joanne O'Riordan Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
Hello and welcome back to the Joanne O'Riordan Podcast on Cork's Red FM with me, Joanne O'Riordan. In episode 4, part 2 of our Rob Hartnett interview, we ask him about what it means for equal play, equal pay, and what that means from a business point of view and all the implications associated with it. I was just curious actually as well to get your opinion on, you know, obviously this World Cup, it was the tipping point for equal play, equal pay. In the USA context anyways. And Tony Duggan, who would be like huge over in England, she played at Barcelona, she's now at Atletico Madrid. She came out and she said, actually, I don't think we should be getting equal pay because I don't think we're bringing in as much as the men. Do you think, again, from a purely business point of view, that's a fair argument? Or do you think this has turned into more of a morality thing more than anything else?
Brilliant question. And not an easy one to answer.
It's definitely difficult because you don't want to be attacked from all angles, you know?
It is. If you look at, you know, particularly international sport, you know, club sport is somewhat different because club sport, you might be getting 80% of the revenue which is coming in is actually going out in talent wages. At an international level, that's not, you know, nobody is playing international football in order to, you know, in order to make themselves financially secure. So there's a stipend, there's a payment that goes to your international players there. And that really should be equal in the same way as it should be equal pay to give to a criminologist, whether she's called Joanne or whether he's called Rob. Mm-hmm. There's no difference in what you're doing in terms of, you know, the job that you're doing. So, you know, we should be paid equally because it's just a certain set of skills. And
I don't pick David's advocate here, but even though they're only bringing X amount of revenue in comparing to the billions that the men are bringing in, because I know that's more of a historical, cultural thing, you know what I mean?
It is. But again, I think you're just sort of trying to move the dial. Like, it's not, you know, ironically enough, because it was centered on the US women's team, the US women's team was actually bringing in more money than the US men's team.
Yep.
And, you know, we'll see the Victory Tour will pack out stadia all across the country. You know, Ireland playing in there as well. It was brilliant, brilliant night. You know, so they would have been taking in more money. But I still think that you look at it and you're making a statement on it. Like, if there is so much money coming into the sport generally, you can cut it, slice it, dice it, whichever way you want. You can say that men's game is bringing in more, but if you look at the demographic of the fan base, it might be that the fan base is 60% male versus 40% female. So therefore, you know, so women are invested in sport regardless. And I do think that if you're making a payment to a player at an international level, that it should be based on them playing international sport, as opposed to being necessarily what crowds that they can bring in.
Yeah.
And even if that doesn't make sense to the financial controller, I still think it's the kind of thing which you have to do in terms of being, you know, making equality actually real.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to, nobody is going to shout down a campaign that effort is equal and yeah, can't see, can't be, all of those wonderful things. And nobody is going to say, no, it's completely wrong. We should keep, you know, women in sport completely on the sidelines, make them play on the bad pitch, make them, you know, sort of play, you know, train at 5 o'clock in the evening on a Friday because the, you know, the under 20 team or the under 18 men's team has got the pitch in the key times of it. We have to make it normal for women to be playing sport in the same way as men are playing sport. And if at international level, that means that you're making the same payment to somebody traveling over from London to play for the Republic of Ireland in the men's team or the women's team, then great. Now, at Arsenal level, if Louise Quinn would demand the same wages as Nicolas Pepe or, you know, Koscielny or somebody else,
yep,
on the Arsenal men's team, that's a different argument to make because there really is a correlation between what they're paid and what they're actually attracting in. But at international level, I think that's where you make a statement. That's where you say, I don't care whether you're tall or small. I don't care whether you're black or white. I don't care whether you're a man or a woman. You're representing your country, playing a sport which is basically the same, you deserve to be paid equally.
Yeah, I suppose that is actually interesting because, I mean, I know like different clubs are like trying to get their women's team on board. Like I know, was it Barcelona gave something like 10 million? And I remember like you're looking at it and you're like, wow, 10 million. And then you see Lionel Messi's getting that, you know, just in a month, you know, just merely existing. And you're like, oh, okay. But at the same time, it's that ability to understand, which is more like, it's more of a cultural thing and a societal thing more than anything else. Like it's us who's getting the demand off Lionel Messi rather than the demand off like a Tony Duggan or someone like that.
It is.
You know,
and
Barcelona are well within their rights to put that, to give us more Lionel Messi because we want it.
Yeah, and coming back to something that we said a little bit earlier as well about the fact of, you know, it not always being the big picture. It's sometimes the small little steps that you take along the way. The Chelsea women's team manager was over speaking at a Liberty Insurance event earlier on this year, and she's absolutely brilliant talking about it. But one of the key things that I took away from it was the fact that she had pushed the chair and the committee in Chelsea Football Club on the fact that when they used to go to the training pitch, there was the first team academy set up, and then there was the women's academy set up, and then there was the underage. There was three buildings. So it was always the first team was just taken by nature as being the men's.
Yeah.
It wasn't called the men's first team. It was called the first team academy. So she insisted that it became the changing in the nomenclature, so that you've got the men's set up and you've got the women's set up, and they were equal in terms of facilities. They were equal in terms of, of respect. As opposed to it just being, oh, well, if it's the first team, then that's obviously the men's. So it's in those simple, small little changes that you can make. And sometimes that doesn't necessarily equate to euros and cents or pounds and pennies, but it's in the way that you're actually talking about sport, the way that you're talking about individuals and the effort that they're putting into it. That's what we've got to do. And it's a long journey. It's not going to happen overnight. But, you know, in 20 years' time, maybe that's too long. Maybe it'll have to be in 10 years' time. You know, we're always impatient for change when we see that something is so obviously in need of change. But I do think that, you know, you have to, maybe it's the older I get, the more that you actually look at the long-term picture. And I think we're moving in the right direction in relation to that.
Because I always like joke with my parents, like, it's the reeling in the years factor. Like, I watch something from the 1970s, I'm reeling in the years, and I laugh about it. And my mother was like, that's the norm. Like, that was the norm when I was your age. Like, and I think it's something that we'll be looking back at in 20 years' time. We'll be like, really? You didn't pay the women equally, you know, but they're selling out stadiums, you know. We'll all be like, oh, well, 20 years ago, we weren't selling out stadiums, you know.
Touch wood.
Yeah.
But I do. I think that it is so obviously the right thing. And I think that society has moved towards a much more equal footing. Not quite there yet, even in that. But, it's only 100 years ago since men were the only ones who could vote. Women weren't allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were all these arguments. Oh, well, they wouldn't really want to, you know, that it'd be too much of a burden on them. And, you know, all of these ridiculous reasons and arguments that you use to actually sort of, you know, sustain, a patriarchy, maintaining the status quo. It's always difficult to chip away at that, but you just have to do it. You know, every day you wake up and you think, what can I do today? And if you didn't get anything done today, what can I do tomorrow?
You
wake up tomorrow and you think, what can I do today? So you just, you know, it's the small steps that always make the greatest change, as opposed to the big, you know, statement event.
I always say it's a snowball effect. It's the person underneath, like the duck in the snowball. Like, if you push it, it's really small at the start, and then it gathers momentum, and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and all of a sudden you're at the bottom of the hill and you're the same size as everyone else.
Yeah, you know? I've never put a duck in a snowball before.
Paddle underneath, you know, that's the duck thing. You paddle underneath, but everyone sees you seamlessly going across the water, but the effort you're putting underneath is a different story.
Absolutely.
That's kind of the vibe I was going for. I was going very metaphorical there for no reason.
Yeah, I know. God, anybody who's just tuning in now at this point in the podcast would be thinking, what on earth are they?
Or maybe someone has fallen asleep because they're like, way too many figures are going on at the moment. I was curious as well, when you're advertising a women's event, do you find that you're advertising it specifically for a younger audience? And I mean that in the nicest way possible. Like, we saw kind of after this Women's World Cup, you know, like the Thailand and the USA game, people were giving out that the USA weren't more respectful because it was specifically being advertised for children. Like, you know, a 6-year-old now is going to go out and do the Megan Rapinoe, God forbid. You know, that was the joke that was like going around, you know.
Yeah.
Do you find that it's a bit different when you're advertising? Like, when you're advertising a men's game, we love the big hits. We love the clashes. We love, like, the Clash of the Ash as an example. You know, we love things like that. Whereas with women, it's different socially. We don't like seeing that. Even like UFC, we didn't like Ronda because Ronda was getting her face kicked in.
Yeah, possibly. Well, look, you know, Katie Taylor.
Yeah.
You know, in the early days of Katie Taylor, people were still saying, I'm not really comfortable with watching women in a boxing environment. It's a sporting environment. You know, if you're not comfortable with it, then why are you comfortable with watching men punching each other?
Yeah.
If that's what your objection is, then it should be an equal objection across men and women, because, you know, people punching each other outside of a sporting context is not a great thing. Looking at the, again, really interesting point. I think one of the things that if you're promoting women's sport, you are promoting to the age group where you can make the biggest difference.
Okay.
And it has been the case that we've had fewer girls we've had an equal number of girls that are coming in through, you know, you go into, you know, to a national school and there's equal opportunity for boys and girls. You move to secondary school and those opportunities begin to diverge. And we lose an awful lot of girls still between the ages of 13 and 14. And there's any number of different reasons. There's, you know, the different ways that we're changing biologically. Body image has got a part to play in it. But that's something that we can actually, you know, we can target and we can actually make a change on. You know, you kind of sit through a summer of watching Love Island and you despair at times about, you know, are we really making any progress in terms of body image? But that's, you know, that's a really important thing as well. And I think you're right. It may be that it's potentially, we kind of accept that young boys will want to kick a ball or will want to make a tackle or will want to hit a, you know, a ball in with some form of implement.
Yeah.
And maybe we're kind of trying to focus a little bit too much on making sure that girls want to do that as well. Maybe we should just let it happen. Maybe we should just give them the facilities, give them the opportunity the same as we would to boys without trying to sort of, you know, push it on them too much. But it is, you know, we're in a place at the moment where there is a difference between the way that we look on men and boys playing sport and women and girls playing sport. And so sometimes you need to actually sort of, you know, force it a little bit in order to just close that gap.
Do you think we need to go full on like the way America did and go like put it into legislation, like make it a policy?
Do you know, we do in almost every other aspect of life. Like there is legislation there which actually, you know, prevents you from paying a person differently because, mm-hmm. you know, based on gender or race or creed. And yet that doesn't exist in sport. You know, the legislation that they introduced in the 1970s over in the United States made a huge difference. That's why the USA team was winning the World Cup, because all of the money that was going into sports programs in American football and, you know, was the primary side of it. So all that money was going in, but there was no sport of American football for women. So if they had to spend an equal amount of money on it, then they had to up the money that they were putting into more traditional women's sports. And soccer was one of the ones to benefit from that. So there was a lot more money going into women's sport in college level. And that's what filters through. Now, if that was from 1970, Title IX is 40 odd years old now. And maybe it's taken that long. That's 10 World Cup cycles. Again, it comes back to the long game.
Yeah.
Should we do it? Well, yes. You know, would we consider putting in a different factor of money into boys' education as opposed to girls' education? No, that would be completely wrong in every way, shape and form. So, yeah, maybe we do need to do that. Maybe we need to, you know, to legislate in order to actually sort of force that, you know, that change in priorities. And even saying it, it feels almost wrong because it's the kind of thing that we should just do because it's the right thing.
It feels weird, like in 2019, we're talking about should we put something in legislation that is in there like 40 years ago in other countries.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, maybe that is what we need. I mean, ultimately, you have to look at where you want to get to at the end game. And in the end game, we want for sport to be the thing, regardless as to whether it's men's sport or women's sport. But until we get to that point, we have to focus on women's sport in order to close the gap. And whatever we need to do in order to get that to a point where, you know, our children and our grandchildren feel as though it's just the absolute normal thing to do, that's what we need to do.
Yeah. I just kind of want to jump back there to the actual business and sport for business and everything that you do in general. And I was curious when I went online, I read the bio that you have and it says, you know, we can export in business in ways that go well beyond the standard forms of sponsorship and hospitality. And in my head, I look at that and I think of like all the thousands that I have to pay to go to a Champions League game, like mentally as a normal fan. And I don't mean that like towards you, but I mean it just in general. Like when I hear the word sport and business in my head, I'm like, is that the reason why a Champions League ticket costs so much? You know, not specifically down to you, but is it because we're now catering more to make sport like more businessy? Do you know what I mean?
I think it's like anything in life. There's a kind of a supply and demand.
Okay.
So if I wanted to, you know, to go to Turner's Cross to see Cork playing against St. Pat's or Cavantilly in, you know, in the FAI Cup, there's a certain level of demand there. You have to cover your costs or go as close as you can towards covering your costs, but then you don't want to pitch it too high because then you'll turn people off. There's never going to be a ticket available to go to a Champions League final, whether it be in Milan or in Madrid or, you know, or in the Ukraine.
But I think this year now is a bit more, there's a bit more focus on it because a lot of tickets were given to corporations for the boxes and things like that, and fans were less reduced, like we saw in Baku. Like a lot of Arsenal fans couldn't go. One, because Baku was so far away. But two, a lot of the tickets were given to corporates, UEFA people, you know.
Yeah, I think that's right. So there was an argument about this when Croke Park was being redeveloped as well. Mm-hmm. And there was this premium level, this ring of seats.
I was going to say, because I even looked at the Croke Park website and I was even curious when it said, our aim is to keep businesses together, both long term on and off the pitch.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, in my head, I'm like, that's not very fan friendly in the normal sense.
No, but if you look on it, the work is towards, yes, encouraging business and encouraging hospitality, because that's what a business is able to pay more than you or I as an individual to actually attend a match and to go and enjoy it. So by putting that ring of premium seating around in the middle of Croke Park, that actually helps to pay at a far higher level than putting in, you know, extending Hill 16 and the terracing by, you know, by putting an extra 5,000 fans on there. Putting an extra 5,000 fans around in the premium enables the stadium to be built. So we could have ignored that, and we could have said, no, sport is something purer than finance and purer than business. And so in order to maintain that, we will settle for a stadium which has got a 60,000 capacity. Would that have been the right thing to do? I really don't think so. I think that, again, the investment of business and corporate investment in sport, it actually enables sport to reach out to far more people. Whether that be through the medium of a television screen or whether it be through the medium of actually allowing more people to actually go into a stadium. You know, the Gaelic Grounds is now the LIT Gaelic Grounds. So Limerick Institute of Technology have got a long-term partnership there. Most of the GAA grounds around the country, a lot of them have got a naming rights and a sponsorship deal in there, which actually means that you can get more people in and you can actually keep the price down, because if you've got a revenue target and you can meet some of that through sponsorship, it means you don't have to meet it through ticket sales. Mm-hmm. So everybody actually proves to be a winner if you can get over the notion that business is not going to corrupt sport. And that's where some people still have a struggle. They think that, no, it's something which is pure. It's something which should be beyond the realms of that. But actually, the business and the corporate side of it enables sport to take place at a higher level and a wider level than it ever could without it.
I was going to say, I remember I was at when I was in New York for the UN, I went over to a baseball game. And I remember they were telling me about Jeff Murad, and he owns like loads of like Major League Baseball teams. And I remember his quote, and I was going to read it to you just to like get your opinion on it. So he said, the obligation of ownership creates more of a public trust feeling than running any other business. The ownership group has the responsibility for the long-term viability of the franchise. It has to make bottom line decisions that are best for them. But the last thing that the fans care about is a discussion about profitability. They only want to win. Do you find when you're selling for a business that's, it's harder to sell a sport because the fans only want to win? They don't, like, we're seeing Man United and Ed Woodward's coming out and he's like, oh, but look at all the money we have. And all the Man United fans are like, yeah, we're sixth.
Yeah.
Do you find that's that's where the relationship breaks down big time? Even Arsenal is another example.
Yeah, nobody cares about the financial results of a football organisation in their head until it comes to the point that they're not able to compete in the professional world with the best players. And that's the point at which that line just becomes a little bit more blurred. So that, you know, Manchester City fans, now 20 years ago, Manchester City, I think, were being relegated from the second tier to the third tier.
Yep.
And there would be fans there that said, no, this is our club. This is what we really like. This is what we really enjoy. And then investment came into Manchester City so that now they're winning the Premier League and they're competing in the Champions League at the very highest level. The reason they're doing that is because money has come into it. They've got a fabulous new stadium there, as opposed to the old stadium that they had, which was a bit ramshackle. You can always say that, look, you know, it's never about money. They shouldn't be taking a dividend out of that. They should be putting it more into the players. But if you take that to its logical conclusion, then they'll never make any money, so they'll never be able to invest. So it's a basic principle of any business or any of ourselves, that we have to budget in order to give ourselves the best possible life based on what we've actually got coming in. And if by investing in players, they get to win more games, they get to attract more fans, they get to sell more jerseys, they get more money, they get to invest more players, they get better players, there's a real virtuous circle that actually goes into that. There will be points on that scale where it tips out a little bit. And you're right, you know, should UEFA have gone to Baku with the Europa League final? Possibly not. You know, that would have been a money decision.
I was going to say, but business-wise, that was the good decision. And I mean that in the nicest way possible. Like, it was to bring the game to a country that has never seen it on such a big level. It was to, like, that was the thing that was being spun out, but everyone was saying, it's just a salvage your own back pockets.
Yeah, and I think, you know, anything like that where you're actually sort of, you know, you're bringing fans to an outlier. Yes, there are arguments that you can make for doing it, but for the biggest of the events, like we've got, you know, the Euro 2020 that will be coming to, you know, Ireland and coming to Dublin, you know, for the first time ever in 2020, as well as it's going to cities all across Europe. And that's a brilliant idea. But the ticket prices, you know, people were giving out and they were saying, oh, God, yeah, but how much are the tickets going to be? The window closed a couple of, you know, went back in on July the 12th for actually getting access to those tickets. But the one of the things in it is they've got a fans first policy in there as well. So I was able to put in, I applied for, you know, for as many tickets as I could, which was four, I think, on the, you know, for the games in Dublin. But I was also able to apply for tickets to go and see the final, go and see the, you know, the European Championship final taking place in Wembley Stadium. And if Ireland get there, I'm in a pot, which I will hopefully, possibly get drawn out of. And the price of the ticket that I'd be paying for that is 90 euros.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 90 euros to go and see the final of the European Championship, I actually think is reasonably good value.
Yep.
I think, you know, I'll probably pay 80 euros or maybe 90 euros this year to go and see Dublin, hopefully, in an All-Ireland football final. I'll pay 30 euros or 40 euros to go and see the Dublin ladies, hopefully, in an All-Ireland football final. But the, you know, all the way along there, I've been able to bring along my kids and pay a fiver for them to go and see the game. So there's a mix. They need to charge enough in order to make the whole system work, but they also need to charge little so that you can actually encourage kids to come along and people to come along and fans to come along. And I do think that 90 euros for a European Championship final, if Ireland are there, where I've got as much chance as you or has got as much chance as anybody else of being drawn out of the hat for it, I think that's pretty fair.
Okay, yeah. I know, it's interesting because even I'd be kind of thinking the same way. Like, I suppose we are moving a little bit closer, but, you know, I suppose then it comes a time where you're getting, like, a bit more, I suppose, uncomfortable with the way things are going, like, business-wise. Like, I remember when I was, like, way younger, I remember when Roman Abramovich bought Chelsea. And I remember my dad saying, oh, that's just to be, like, cool and have a football team. And Abramovich said basically the same thing. He was like, everyone has a football team. It's a billionaire thing. I want to have a football team too. And then you saw, you know, the likes of, you know, the Abu Dhabi group buying out Man City and, you know, Qatar with PSG. And all of a sudden, the cool thing of having a football team turned into, like, a weird, and I know Man City fans and PSG fans are going to go mental, it turned into, like, a propaganda thing, you know, for a lot of people. And a lot of people were getting a bit uncomfortable. Like, it was, you know, for Nasser to be able to come out, you know, and say, oh, but look at all the wonderful stuff I'm doing in terms of football. And then you look at what's going on in Qatar and you're like, oh, I see.
Yeah. it is. And, you know, it got to that point where it was really fashionable to have a football team.
Mm-hmm.
I think in football, it was probably never really that much different. It used to be that it was the owner of the local mill that would fund the local football team.
Yeah.
So maybe things haven't changed other than in scale. But, you know, Arsenal won a sponsorship award recently for the work that they're doing with Visit Rwanda.
Yep.
What that has to do with, you know, a North London suburb and the fans that has is kind of difficult to imagine. But they have. They've moved into that world in the Premier League now, where it is purely global. And, yeah, there is an element of, you know, if you want to make your reputation better, then you invest in a football club which people love with their hearts, and you buy a part of that affection. That's part of the trade-off for getting involved in the sponsorship side of it. And yeah, I think that clubs need to be aware of that as well, because again, there'll be a tipping point somewhere along the scale. Chelsea fans would never have heard a bad word said about Roman Abramovich and would have felt bad for him when he was refused, you know, sort of the passport,
yeah,
and things like that. And they felt that was, you know, that was out of order because of the amount that he'd invested in their club. But it's purely tribal, you know, football and sport.
I was going to say, because even Manchester now, to hear Manchester people talking about Abu Dhabi and they can't find it on a map, you know, but all of a sudden they're telling you about, like, all the atrocities being committed. You're like, do you know where Abu Dhabi is? Like, do you know what's been going on? Like, the historical context. It's kind of funny in a way, like.
It is. And you
it's know, not because people are dying. I want to point that out.
No. And it gets to a point where the bigger clubs are, they're playing at such a high level in terms of corporate and in terms of, you know, the responsibility they have. You know, Barcelona getting involved in programs to feed the world.
Yep.
That's so far beyond where a football team based in a particular city would have ever imagined themselves. But by virtue of media, by virtue of us as fans wanting to buy into that success, wanting to buy into all of the big things, they do have a sense of corporate social responsibility now. And being able to do that in the right way is really important. Being able to fund that in the right way is really important. Getting the balance right between where you're getting the funding from and what you're spending the money on is a challenge which is ongoing, I would imagine, in every boardroom, whether it be from the very top of the Premier League down to the lowest levels of, you know, the Allianz National League and GAA. Balancing the books, really important. But that sense, as you said, with the, you know, in New York, the ownership of a sports team, whether that be through community or whether that be through an individual or whether it be through a corporation, there's a real sense of trust that you have to, you're holding people's dreams and hopes in your hand. And it's really important to treat that carefully and with due care and attention.
Is that harder to sell into like a business guy? So say you're over Man City, you're flying out to the Sheik, you're trying to explain all this to him. Is the Sheik looking at you going, and what? You know, because everyone always says that Sheik's actually not that interested, Sheik Mansour is not that interested in football, but now he's liking it. Same as Dan Kroenke, I remember him saying like, I don't really like NFL, but I bought the Rams anyways.
Yeah, you know, a collection of words, like, I mean, it might be 10 words of a statement that you throw off in an interview and it can come back to haunt you 10, 20 years down the line.
Yeah.
Owners and corporations need to be really careful about the language they use in that sense as well, because you can say something and you might not even mean it. He might have said, yeah, look, I'm not really a big football fan. What he might have meant was to say that I'm not obsessed with football to the same extent as a lot of the fans. But it comes across as wrong, that if you're not as obsessed about my team as I am, then you're not as big a fan as I am. Therefore, I'm not going to have as much respect for you in relation to that particular team or club or county as is. I think that it's really important, though, to make sure that all of the dots join up. Mm-hmm. So the club has to take its responsibility to the fans very seriously. And it also has to take its responsibility to its sponsors seriously. But it does need to draw a few lines so that if the sponsor might come in, and we've seen a few examples of this in English soccer as well, that, you know, Cardiff City, you know, because they're in Wales, the owner thought it was more appropriate they should play in red, but their nickname has always been the Bluebirds.
Yeah.
So they wanted to change the kit to being red. That's so far out of sync with what your fan base is about that it just, we all look at that and we think, geez, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Hull City, I think they were being, their name was being
Hull City
changed.
Tigers.
That's right, yeah. Just, you know, small things in the eyes of a big corporation or an owner who's living over in the, on the far side of the world. Absolutely massive things to the fan who has gone the same way as their grandparents went beforehand and the way that their parents went beforehand. So we as fans, we hold in trust, we hold a really importance on what a club means and what it, how it matters within our community and within our own lives. So it's up to us as well to actually tell and to, you know, to say what is on our minds to the individual owners and the individual clubs so that they're getting it right as well. But everybody is in the mix there as well. It's not going to be down to some big, bad, evil corporation. That's kind of cartoon stuff. That's, you know, that there's somebody bad and evil over there that is just using, you know, it's using my hopes and dreams in order to further its own ambitions. There's a process of communication and consultation that has to go on between the two. And if the balance is wrong, then a club needs to have the guts to actually walk away and to value its own integrity to a higher degree than might otherwise be the case.
But it's even like the weird Amazon, like Amazon Prime Day. Like someone came out recently and were like, the only reason there's Amazon Prime Day is because Jeff doesn't want you to know that his workers are underpaid. You know, there's like, and in my head, I'm like, yeah, but Amazon Prime Day is so nice. Like, look at the amount of stuff I get to buy for a ridiculous price.
Yeah, we are motivated by what matters most to us.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't find too many Manchester City fans now that we're giving out about Sheikh Mansour.
No, they're not like
Man United fans. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everything he's doing is wrong. But Man City fans, well, you know, we won the Premier League again and we're able to sign X, Y and Z players. You know, so we do. We, and, you know, same in politics as well. You kind of tend to vote for the politician who says that they're going to get that particular pothole fixed or that they're going to give you that much more back in your pay packet. You know, we're humans. That's the way that we tend to operate.
Because sometimes it's really funny, like when I hear the Man City fans talking about it, I'm like, that is the most Irish thing you could possibly say. Like, you know, at a national level, we're all like, oh, the Healy Rays are bad, but you go to Kerry and it's like, well, they fixed the road. And you're like, well, of course, like, that's why you like them. You know, I was going to say in Ireland is a bit more, you find that attitude comes out a bit more like, you know, like I remember when Sean Quinn, everything started with him and all the Cavan people were like, well, everyone's wrong. Like, he's great.
Yeah, that's right. You see, Irish influence on world sport, it knows no bounds.
I know, like, because I'm literally looking at it, I'm thinking, like, mad. But, like, just in general, like, is it different than in Ireland? Because I feel like everyone knows everyone. So things like that make it a bit awkward. You know, like, there's no way that you can say something really bad about Allianz because, by God, you know someone who's sponsored by Allianz is living down the road from you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that is the case. Like, you know, they say that this whole idea of 7 degrees of separation, but in Ireland it's probably closer to 0.7 degrees of separation that everybody knows somebody. I think in a sporting context, Ireland is, I hate to use the word unique because it's never quite that, but we're definitely different to most sporting areas in that we do have the GAA, which is so central to what sport is all about. You know, if you're operating in England, the whole community base of sport is vastly different. Whereas here, we treasure sport a little bit more, not for the medals and the cups and the trophies, but for what it does within our local communities. You know, the GAA attracts an awful lot of the sporting talent that might otherwise be competing in Olympic sports or competing, you know, for the Irish soccer team or the Irish rugby team. And sometimes there's a transition across that, but it is at its heart still very much community based. And while sponsorship and revenue does come into it, and like it's a multi-million turnover business, it's still rooted in terms of the community. Like the campaign which began this year, Where We All Belong, it really speaks to anybody who's involved in the GAA. Now,
cynical will say, we belong to what though?
Oh yeah, people on the outside will look at it and they'll think that just doesn't make any sense and they don't get it. And that's fine.
Because my brother texted me, he was like, I liked it. It felt very like we're reciting the new 1916 proclamation on a GAA. Like, he loved it. Whereas I was like, but what do we belong to?
I know.
You know, like, I found it a bit weird. But maybe that was a criminologist in me going, you know, reading a bit in between the lines.
Possibly being too analytical.
Yeah.
And not accepting it on the emotional level. But it worked for me and it worked for a lot of people that I would have known. What do we all belong to? Well, we all belong to each other. We all belong to this community, which extends beyond the parish lines, which extends beyond the county lines, to being, you know, a person who just loves the GAA. But I always say the GAA is it's a little bit like a bumblebee. Like if you look at the way that the GAA works, it shouldn't work at all. It shouldn't work.
No, completely.
So many people would put so much time in a volunteer capacity. You know, whether I'm coaching my kids' teams or I'm involved in a fundraiser for the club, or somebody else is getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to, you know, to line a pitch because failure is taking place that weekend. All of these things that go into it shouldn't work. Like it should be, you know, there's so much money in sport. People say, oh, well, look, you have to get something out of it. And it just doesn't work like that. So, but it works brilliantly. If you tried to transplant that and set it up now from scratch, people would laugh at you.
Yeah.
And yet it is such an important part of our sporting context. And everybody, even within soccer and within rugby and within rowing and within badminton and everything else, will still look to the GAA as being either an inspiration or a template and a model for how they can actually work within their own communities as well. And I think that's really important, that whole sense of collaboration, that because the greatest thing is that we're all into sport as opposed to one particular sport or another. I think that's really important not to lose sight of, that you can always... You always want to hold out a helping hand to somebody else who can make a difference and do some good within their sport. Even if it's not something completely related to you, do the right thing and hold out your hand.
I always think as well that Ireland's a bit different. Like when I moved to York on an Erasmus program for a year, and I remember I went to see York City play, and it just wasn't, and I know this sounds like really like, oh, patriotic and pride, but it wasn't the same. Like, I mean, the minority were the ones that were, you know, lining the pitch at 8 o'clock that morning, you know, handing out the jerseys, things like that. Whereas I found when I went back to Ireland and went to a Cork City game or like my local GAA game, I found it was the majority that were helping out as much as possible.
Yeah, that's right. And somebody like Niamh O'Mahony, who was being involved in the Cork Supporters Trust that owns the club now and is now sitting on the FAI council and looking to drive change from the inside. You know, you're putting in that time and you're putting in that effort. And so is your cousin, and so is your neighbour, and so is your friend, which is what makes it feel right that you should be doing it too. And, you know, we've got a much closer family bond, I still think, in Ireland. We've still got a much closer community bond. And those things matter. Very difficult to define, very difficult to paint a box around and say, well, that's why we're different. And if we take that and we apply that to somewhere else and somebody else, that it will work as well. It just doesn't work like that. There is something special about what we've got here, and we should never lose sight of that.
I remember, yeah, I landed just as the replay of the All-Ireland, the Dublin and Mayo one was happening, and my housemates came in, and it was like the first time they got to know me, and I was like watching the game, and I was like trying to explain to them, and the way I made it sound was like the big bad wolf of Dublin versus the little boys of Mayo. Now in my head I'm like, I feel like that's reverse now. I feel we're all like, oh my god, if Mayo win, we're never going to hear the end of it. But if the five in a row happens, we're never going to hear the end of that, you know. But I was like laughing because they were looking at me and they were like, you've just created like a novel, like a fairy tale. And I was like, well, that's life actually.
It is, yeah. And I'm sure that if we play back to ourselves how we talk about things like that, it would sound a little bit crazy. But it is a little bit crazy. Mm-hmm. Like the, you know, the passion that is extended into a championship weekend is so huge. Mm-hmm. And I'm a Dublin fan, so I'm, you know, I'm there on Hill 16, and it's lovely to be hated by everybody.
You're not in the cute ring around.
Because you know that you're not hated.
No, I was going to say, you're not in the cute ring, you're in Hill 16, are you?
No, honestly, yeah, I would. I'd be much more likely to be there than, you know, than up in the corporate seats. I'm a fan.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that when All-Ireland tickets come around, yeah, I'd be delighted, whatever way you can get them.
I know.
By all means. But no, normally it is. It's through the club. So you're actually sort of, you know, getting things like that you know, through the right channels.
That's always the thing as well about Ireland. No matter how big you get, you are ringing your local person who you grew up with and saying, can I get a ticket?
Oh, yeah. I've got an equal number of people now for the All-Ireland Hurling Final that would be sort of WhatsApping and texting any chance if you come across any tickets. And it'd be an equal number from Tipperary and from Kilkenny. And, you know, that doesn't happen in sport on a general basis.
No.
If I'm living in New York, it's, you know, and the Mets and the Yankees are coming up against each other, it's going to be from one section or the other. Whereas here, we are all GAA fans together. Yeah. And, you know, I would sit down and watch the All-Ireland Hurling Final, regardless as to whether Dublin are in it. The All-Ireland Football Final, regardless as to whether Dublin are in it. And, you know, people from outside of Dublin do sometimes forget that there was a 16-year period when Dublin were as far from an All-Ireland Final as Leitrim. And, you know, and that will happen again. Maybe not for a year or two, but it will happen again because sport is cyclical in its nature like that.
You definitely think that's cyclical.
I
again, I'm playing devil's advocate here, like I'm like, yeah, you know, because I met a lot of Dub fans who were telling me this is forever.
No,
deal with it, Joanne. I was
it
like,
is
all
definitely
right,
not forever. I remember there was a great piece which the Irish Times had written on the morning of the All-Ireland Football Final in 1982 when Kerry were going for the five in a row, and you could actually buy tickets. You could walk up to the stadium that day and buy tickets because Kerry had so strangled the sport of Gaelic football that it's dead. So they're going to win it forever. Nobody can compete with them. It's just so boring, and you know, it's just Kerry this and Kerry that. All you have to do is just translate the words out from, you know, from Kerry to Dublin, and that year Offaly did the unthinkable and mm-hmm. they beat them. We've seen it with Kilkenny in the hurling, and you know, Kilkenny are just so strong, and oh, it's just boring now, and it's boring seeing the same team win. But it never lasts. It never goes on forever. And this is, you know, it's a very special Dublin manager. It's a very special group of Dublin players. But if you look at the underage, you know, there hasn't been as much success anywhere near for Dublin as for Kerry. Like Kerry have won their five in a row. They've won five in a row minor football titles. But nobody is saying, oh, well, look, Kerry should actually be forced to stop playing, you know, at the age of 16, as opposed to now 17, as opposed to 18. Find some way to, you know, to stop them from doing it. They will be stopped. They will lose.
I was going Donald Trump and building a wall around Kerry. You know, it got so bad from a Mill Street perspective. I was ready. I was ready to go.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and you'd be close as well. Yeah, I've been on that train down to Killarney. And you go through Mill Street and you're sort of, yeah, you're very
close. We're only 5 miles from the border. Yeah, I never thought I'd ever relate to Donald Trump, but there you have it. When Kerry are winning in a Munster final, you're very close to it. You're very close to chanting build the wall.
I've never put you and Donald Trump into the same box, but there you go.
There you go. Sport does weird things to a lot of people. I want to talk to you just lastly about your Sport for Good initiative, because I was really curious about that. You know, we see, like, I suppose, how sponsorship and businesses can be good. We've got the Lidl and LGFA is like the main example here in Ireland. But what you're working with is the Sports for Good initiative, the Super Troopers, the Give a Child a Ball with Allianz and Sports United Communities up in the north. They're very important initiatives to have right now. Now that sport, as a microcosm of society, is becoming, because we had a sports sociologist in, and she said sport is a reflection of society, and I found that really interesting.
It is,
and the Sports for Good is reflecting better than upon society.
I do. I think it's a really good thing that we're the space that we occupy is that sort of no man's land between sport and business, mm-hmm. and Sport for Social Good is something that I tried to get off the ground 3 years ago, and it didn't quite fly, but dog with a bone, didn't want to give up on it. We brought Allianz on board to actually support it. And Last year, we brought over the CEO of the Manchester United Foundation. Mm-hmm. And this year, we had the Director of Sustainability with the RNA, and we did it up as part of the Open Championship up in Royal Portrush. And it's sport for social good in its widest context. So it could be in terms of bringing good initiatives through the prism of sport into groups and communities and areas where the greater need is. So in Manchester United's case, it was into areas of disadvantage. In the RNA's case, it was into sustainability. And, you know, we're already looking at what we'll be doing for next year. But a lot of the organizations that are sponsoring are looking to get involved in projects that make a difference on the ground. You mentioned the Super Troopers with Leia Healthcare. They're doing that in an education perspective. The AIG with Dublin GAA, but also with a lot of other sports as well, they're really pushing on the equality side of it. So AIG sponsored in tennis. They sponsored the Men's Open. There hadn't been a Women's Open in tennis for a number of years. And they said, well, look, we'll support you, but we want to have a Women's Open championship as well. So again, that's an idea. That's an area of social good.
Do you think businesses have that power that they're able to say, if you don't have a women's thing, screw it?
You never know until you ask.
Yeah.
But I think businesses now are concerned enough about their own reputation, concerned enough about the reputation from internally. You know, you don't want to work with a company that's not out there seen as being a company that's doing good things, that's a force for change. I think it's really important. I think it's genuine as well. A lot of people would look at it cynically and they're saying, oh, well, they're just doing that again, just try and make themselves look good through sport. I don't care. If it's actually making a difference on the ground, I think that's a really good thing as well. You know, yourself, when you were speaking at InspireFest, and then the guys from Solvers came up and offered you the 50,000,
yep.
You know, that's hugely important to you,
mm-hmm.
but it's also hugely important to others, because that's not something which is only going to benefit you. And hopefully it will come through. It's something that can actually sort of make a real difference. And I think that's hugely important that, you know, a company like them were able to actually invest in you to get to a wider audience. And that's what we're trying to achieve with this as well. It's just trying to join a few threads together so that companies that want to do good, sport is a universal language which actually reaches out to all sorts of different groups. We've done a lot of work with Special Olympics Ireland. I've got an absolutely beautiful niece that living down here in West Cork, Leisha, who is special needs. And what I see through her, she was that little bit older, so she missed the surge of Special Olympics.
Yeah.
And she never really got into the sport. But I kind of look and I think, you know, kids like her growing into adults that have the similar challenges to her, what sport can do through Special Olympics is just enormous. It's enormous for the person with a disability. It's enormous for the parents and for the whole support structure around them as well. And so helping to, you know, paint a picture where companies can come in and invest in organizations like that that are doing good on the ground is something that, you know, certainly it's something which we can do, which I can do as a small little gesture, which hopefully enables companies that have real power to do it with organizations that are really putting in the work on the ground to make a difference. And yeah, sport for social good is something that really matters. And I think it's something that I'm, you know, happy to have been able to bring about in some small way, shape and form, and something that we definitely want to continue into the future.
It definitely works though, because I always feel that like the little thing that you'd forget about. Like I remember when some insurance company, I can't remember which one it is, they sponsored AIG actually, they sponsored the petrol for the women's football teams, the LGFA teams. Yeah, like something as small as that goes such a long way.
That's right.
Like as we were saying earlier, it's not the Euros in the sense, actually, in the end, it's these little things as well.
Yeah, and to be fair, Top Oil Products over in Galway as well, they were doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And they sort of said, well, look, if we're going to give a fuel card to the men's Mayo team, we're going to give a fuel card to the women's team as well. And again, simple little things which are so obvious, but sometimes you just need to sort of knock on the door and say, what do you think? And yeah, of course. And if they want to get a bit of publicity out of it, well, by all means.
Mm-hmm.
If that means that I'll drive, you know, sort of 5 miles beyond a Texaco garage to go to a Top garage, then that works. That's what sponsorship and that's what, you know, advertising and marketing and promotion does. But on the other side of it, if they're doing something which makes a real difference to the players, makes a real difference to the communities in which they're operating, then by all means, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I suppose just in general, like, you know, to wrap up, like, the future of sportive business is obviously massive. As you were saying, it's not just sponsorships anymore. There's a bigger role, you know, there's a bigger role that sports has to play, and there's a bigger role that businesses have to play. Not to, like, draw a little bit of a negative on it, but, like, I could hear Arsene Wenger in my head going, it's inflation. Once that plug is pulled, it's game over. But do you think that's a relationship that's going to last forever? Let's totally forget about Arsene Wenger thinking it's inflation.
You know, the main driver of it all has been through the media. And, you know, we've talked about the Premier League mm-hmm. and the amount of money that goes into the clubs, into the sport, from Sky, from BT, from the European Broadcasting Union, you know, even from the BBC and RTE. A lot of that has gone in through broadcast. That's changing. And it's probably likely that some of the biggest billion-dollar deals mm-hmm. and billion-euro deals and billion-pound deals that are going in to cover that sport are likely to begin to dip, because media is becoming more fragmented. But one of the things that the Premier League has been you know, has been good at in overseas markets is something that Major League Baseball has been very good at. And to be fair, the GAA, together with RTE and GAA Go, have been good at as well, in terms of providing over-the-top streaming services, so that you can watch a match and you can pay $5, or you can pay you know, whatever the, you know, the Singapore equivalent of, you know, of a euro is, to watch Arsenal playing in the Premier League, or to watch Dublin and Kerry in the GAA All Ireland Championship. And of the billions of people out there in the world for whom sport matters, those small micro payments are probably what's going to take the place of those billion-dollar payments that broadcasting companies have made in the past. And it turns the sporting organisations into broadcasters, but it closes the relationship, so that now it doesn't matter what Sky or RTE or anybody else necessarily wants to broadcast. I'll be able to see it, and I'll be able to actually pay Arsenal €1 to watch an Arsenal match. I think that's probably where it's going to come. And in that sense, even though the plug may be pulled on the big billion-dollar deals, the appeal of sport is going to remain. Yeah. And it's just a different channel through which the funding is going to come from us as fans. But if we as fans are still engaged in it, and for a lot of people, it's the most important thing in our lives, beyond family and beyond health, sport really does matter. And if you're, as a business, if you're looking to appeal to people and you're looking to invest in something which matters to me, in my heart, to you, in you know, the fibre of your being, then sport is still going to be there. So, no, I think that plug is pretty firmly in place.
And you're at the heart of it all, I suppose, in an Irish respect. Not in an arrogant way, but, like, you are bringing these, you are effectively a middleman now. And I think it's an important role, because you're the one making sure everyone is equal on each other's parts. And I think that's an important side as well. So I think you and your role should be commended for that as well. And, you know, I think you should take great pride in knowing that the work you're doing is for good. And you can see it on the ground as well with LGFA teams and even Special Olympics and things like that. So, like, thanks for obviously making such a big difference and making sure that isn't poisoned, that relationship. So you should get a clap for that. And,
well, thanks very much. Kind of you to say so. Honestly, what we do is I kind of hold up a mirror to the work that others are doing. And mm-hmm. if I can hold that at the right angle, then that's really kind of you to say so. And we'll just keep on trying to do the right thing, trying to maintain that relationship between sport and business, so that it works for sport, it works for business, and it works for society, because ultimately that's the glue that binds us all together. So, yeah, no, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no, thanks very much for being on the show. It was an incredibly fascinating conversation. I hope people understand the business role, I suppose, a little bit better, because that was the aim of this conversation, I think. But thanks very much for making it all so clear, and thanks very much for coming down and taking a break on your summer break. So thanks very much, Rob, thanks very much. Thanks for listening to episode 4 of the Rob Hartnett Podcast, CEO for Sports. We'd also like to thank Rob for interrupting time for his holidays with his family and sending his family off to Brown Thomas for a day while he sat down and did the interview. And thanks very much for you for listening to the Joanna Reardon Podcast here on Red FM. Tune in next week where we interview Mara Trasny Kallig, where she talks about life in Galway, growing up wanting to be a sports reporter, and her new life where she's studying to become a doctor. Enjoy, see you then, and cheerio.
The Big Red Bench.
Game on.
Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.